we have scheduled for this morning is a Commonwealth Appeal, Commonwealth versus David Pijor.
Yes, Pijor. You're
Pijor.
The first person to ever get that right.
Yeah, that was a guess. and the Commonwealth represented by Ms. Campbell, Mr. Blanc. You are the representing the appellee in this case. Ms. Campbell, you want to begin when ready?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that is okay.
That's fine.
Thank you. The Commonwealth is asking this court to reverse the decision of the trial court because the trial court erred in dismissing the September 15, 2014 indictment on the grounds of double jeopardy. First, the trial court erred because double jeopardy does not apply to offenses that are distinct and separate acts.
Campbell, this is Judge Humphreys. Let me see if we can cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
We have two indictments. Mm-hmm. Would you agree that they are identical with the single exception of the date of the offense?
Yes. When you read the indictment, they read exactly the same except for the date, yes.
So the same, I mean, there's no issue with respect to the identity of the property stolen. In this case, it's a dog, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
The only issue before us is whether or not these two indictments represent a charge for the same offense or charges for different offenses, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the charge here is larceny, and can we agree that the common law definition of larceny is the taking, stealing, and carrying away of personal property belonging to another without the owner's permission?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so what's the Commonwealth's position as to which of those elements, is it the Commonwealth's position that all of those elements uniquely occurred on both of those days, or is there some overlap?
The Commonwealth's position is that the day the dog originally went missing, September 6, 2013, and the trial took place on February 4, 2014. That was for the taking on the September 6, 2013. The actions on April 29, 2014 are the carrying away and continuous possession of the stolen dog.
So is it your position that the mere possession of stolen property constitutes a larceny?
The possession of stolen property constitutes a larceny when the defendant knows the property is stolen, and in this case, the defendant clearly knew that this property was stolen because he had been on trial for actually the taking. So when he was in possession of it on April 29th, he knew that that property was stolen, and he was violating the property owner's rights by continuing.
Ms. Campbell, this is Judge Petty. Does your argument, your position, rely on our acceptance of the proposition that larceny is a continuing offense for purposes of, I'll use the phrase, units of prosecution?
I think it relies on that fact, in that the venue cases show support for the proposition that gravamen of the offense of larceny is that the property owner's rights continue to be violated when a defendant continues to commit additional actions. And
Judge Tron asked the prosecutor, the Commonwealth attorney, a question that he seemed to have a lot of difficulty answering, and I'll pose it to you. If this individual had kept the dog for 365 days, an entire
mm-hmm.
year, would he be subject to 365 separate and distinct counts of larceny?
No, Your Honor, and I tried to address that in my brief when I related the case to the Baker case from the Supreme Court, the possession of a firearm case, and the Supreme Court had helpful language in that case, which can be applied to this case, because the defendant couldn't have been convicted of multiple counts of grand larceny for every single day he had possessed the dog if there is no proof that he's committing a separate and distinct act against the property owner on each day. But where the Commonwealth can show proof that on this day, April 29, 2014, the defendant was committing these acts by being in direct possession and transporting the dog in such a way and carrying it away from its property owner, then that is a separate and distinct act. But the
let me follow up on that, Ms. Campbell. In Baker, as I'm sure you know, one of the corollaries to the double jeopardy clause is that you can be punished for the same offense if it's crystal clear that the legislature intends multiple punishments for the same offense. And it seems to me that's what the Supreme Court's reasoning in Baker was. In Baker, the Supreme Court reasoned that the General Assembly intended separate punishments in that situation. But here we're dealing with a common law crime where the General Assembly hasn't done anything except set the penalty for the offense. So it seems to me, you know, your argument with respect to Judge Petty's question, or your answer to Judge Petty's question, is, you know, maybe founded on that little quirk in the double jeopardy jurisprudence that permits multiple punishments for the same offense as opposed to consecutive prosecutions for the same offense. I guess, you know, they're nuanced. I guess it's a nuanced difference, but, you know, one's a pure Blackburger analysis and the other is a sort of a pure double jeopardy analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand what you're saying. The Commonwealth would just try to point out that's why I was trying to draw parallels. I guess not parallels is the right word, but argue that the gravamen of the offense of larceny is this deprivation of property rights, which is why it should be able.
I think we can all agree if the General Assembly had passed a statute which defined larceny as and made it clear that it was a separate offense for each day one possessed the property taken, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now. But they didn't do that. This is purely a common law offense. So I'm not sure you can get there from here in terms of the intent of the legislature. I mean, you'd have to be taking a position that a common law, every day the property remained in possession of a thief, it's a separate offense. Or I suppose theoretically it could be, you know, every minute would be a separate offense if we're going to, you know, parse it out like that.
Again, Your Honor, I think the best response I have to that is that the spirit of the cases indicate that when a defendant is committing offense against the property rights of another, that conduct can be separate and distinct from other acts and should be punishable.
Well, that is totally opposite your answer to my question about 365 counts.
Right.
Because each day that your argument is each day the defendant is possessing this stolen property inconsistent with the rights of the owner, that is a separate offense, a separate chargeable offense. And so I want to know, why couldn't the Commonwealth charge 365 counts of larceny and convict on all of them under your argument?
Well, the Commonwealth would have to actually be able to prove that if the Commonwealth could prove that every single day that the defendant or a person in this hypothetical was actually possessing that property, then perhaps they could, but they would actually have to have a witness.
They'd simply have to prove that each of those days he was in possession of the stolen property, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, but if...
So in this case, this happens to be a conviction after acquittal version of double jeopardy. Suppose he had, in this jury trial, he had been convicted of larceny, but they had not recovered the dog. They found him in possession of the dog a month later. Your argument is the Commonwealth could turn around and indict and convict him a second time.
Yes, for the different action, Your Honor, that would be my position.
On the other day that weren't committed on the first day?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Judge Petty just posed you the question, and let's just pick 2 days at random. On day one, he's charged with taking, stealing, and carrying away the dog, and he's acquitted. On day two, he's charged with taking and stealing and carrying away the dog. Now, the only evidence, under your scenario, the only evidence the Commonwealth has is that he's in possession of the stolen dog. And while there is a legal principle that the possessor, you can infer that a person in recent possession of stolen property is the thief, that's a different proposition of whether it's a separate offense. So, I mean, doesn't the Commonwealth typically have to prove what they charge in the indictment, that he took, stole, and carried away the dog on the second date in question?
That's not the Commonwealth, I guess, theory of the case in this case, and unfortunately, I mean, this record isn't quite clear because the Commonwealth didn't put evidence on for a second trial, so we don't have exactly what the Commonwealth would have.
Well, as I understand the record, I wasn't aware there was a dispute about the facts. I thought it was pretty well undisputed that the dog was actually taken on the date charged in the first indictment.
Yes, sorry, Your Honor, that is.
And that the only, and that the Commonwealth's only evidence, other than that presented in the first trial, I should say the Commonwealth's only additional evidence from that presented in the first trial, was that he was in possession of the dog on the date charged in the second indictment. Am I incorrect about that?
Yes, sorry, Your Honor.
So a fact finder concluded that he was not guilty of taking and stealing and carrying away the dog on the first date in question, and the Commonwealth then seeks to prosecute him for taking, stealing, and carrying away the dog on the second date in question, and it's the same dog, and there's no evidence of any new taking. There's only evidence of a possession. Is that correct? Am I wrong about
that?
Yes,
Your Honor. Sorry, I misunderstood your first question. That is correct, Your Honor.
So what elements, I mean, it seems to me the Commonwealth is unable to prove, I realize the case hasn't gone to trial the second time, but it seems to me the Commonwealth would not be able to rise any higher than the evidence it presented at the first trial that where he was acquitted of taking, stealing, and carrying away the dog. The only evidence the Commonwealth has is that he's in possession of the stolen dog. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the evidence the Commonwealth has.
So he's in recent possession of stolen property, and a fact finder could infer from that he's the thief, but he's already been acquitted of being the thief. So why isn't this a classic double jeopardy situation then?
Your Honor, it isn't because the Commonwealth's theory at a second trial would not be that he was the original thief, because he is acquitted of that taking. It is that he subsequently came into possession of the dog, knowing it to be stolen, and continued to
But that's a separate offense. That offense is receipt or aid in concealing of stolen property. That's not 18.2-95. And that's not what he was charged with.
And as I understand the case law also, you cannot be the principal and the person who is receiving the stolen property. That's the way I understand the case law. Is that correct?
Yes. That is my understanding of the case law. As I cited in my brief, when I pointed to Hampton v. Commonwealth and Spite v. Commonwealth, anyone who knows that personal property is stolen and assists in its transportation and disposition is guilty of a larceny, and that would be the Commonwealth theory under this case.
Ms. Kimmel, one final question I've got for you, because you're running short on your time. I asked you some time ago about this in the argument about the concept of you're basing your argument on larceny being a continuing offense. In 1977, the Supreme Court had a case where a defendant stole a car in Richmond and in Smith County, 380 miles away, ran a stop sign and killed somebody. And they were presented with the argument as to whether the legal fiction, as they note, of larceny being a continuing offense for purposes of venue should be extended to provide the felony in a felony murder conviction. And the Supreme Court noted, while we continue to recognize this fiction in support of venue, we decline to extend it, as the Commonwealth would have us do, to satisfy the requirements of felony murder that the accidental killing occurred while the defendant was in the prosecution of a felonious act. Aren't you asking us to do exactly what the Supreme Court declined to do, and that is extend a venue fiction to create a substantive offense?
Unfortunately, I am unfamiliar with that case.
Well, assume it says what I just said it says.
Yes, of course. I think that it can still be differentiated, because while the Commonwealth is using the aspect to try to extend it. It also is, the Commonwealth is trying to just recognize that a very separate and distinct criminal conduct that occurred a couple months after a trial is new conduct that should be able to be prosecuted.
All right, you're well into your rebuttal, but we'll give you a couple extra minutes. And
thank
we,
you, Your Honor.
Teach up pretty good. Thank you. Mr. Blanche, you want to begin?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, I have to tell you, you all have hit on virtually every one of the points I was planning on making, so I will be very brief.
Well, Mr. Blanche, this is Judge Humphreys. Never let it be said that I'm not an equal opportunity abuser, so let me beat you up a little bit. You cite Grady versus Corbin in your brief in support of your double jeopardy claim. Of course, Grady was a same conduct test that the Supreme Court applied in 1990. And I don't know. Are you familiar at all with Grady and what happened to it?
I'm afraid. Is the court indicating that case has been overruled?
Yeah, I mean, it may hold the record for the case that was on the Supreme Court's books the shortest amount of time, because I think within 5 years they had expressly overruled it because of all the unintended consequences. So, you know, I'm going to suggest if you're going to cite cases, you want to make sure that they're still good law. But Grady, which you relied on pretty heavily in your brief, hadn't been good law for, you know, the better part of 20 years now, I think.
Well, I'm afraid I have to apologize.
Let me ask you another question. You also rely heavily on Brown v. Ohio, the Supreme Court case, which seems to be on point, I will grant you. But I note that in footnote 8, the Supreme Court noted that we would have a different case if the Ohio legislature had provided that joyriding is a separate offense for each day in which a motor vehicle is operated without the owner's consent. We would also have a different case if, in sustaining Brown's second conviction, the Ohio courts had construed the joyriding statute to that effect. Doesn't that pretty much diminish the import of that case? Because really what we're asked to decide here is whether the legal fiction of larceny being a continuing offense is, in fact, the law of Virginia.
Well, I'm afraid not. I think that footnote only serves to highlight how exactly on point Brown is. That footnote essentially describes the situation that we found that the court discussed about Baker with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. If unlike grand larceny, the legislature had created a statutory larceny offense and had said every day that you possess this dog is a separate date of offense, then you would have the situation described in that footnote.
But it also notes that it would be a different case if the courts had come to the conclusion that each day a defendant is in possession of stolen property is a separate offense, and that's really the issue before us.
Well, I would suggest to the court that's not the issue that's in front of you, because it is well settled that larceny is a continuing offense under the common law, and that there's no need to do the analysis that Blockberger talks about, where you say, and which was undertaken in Baker and a couple of the other cases that were cited on my brief, where if it's unclear whether the offense is a continuing offense or one that can be punished for each separate incident, then the court looks to the gravamen of the offense and the intent of the legislature to determine whether we're talking about a continuing offense or whether the legislature has intended separate punishments.
But
in this case, we know that they're not.
What about the Supreme Court's statement in Dunleavy that each day that the property is withheld constitutes a new violation of the owner's right of property in possession?
Well, there are a few things about that. The first is, obviously, that's a citation to a case that talks about venue, and Dunleavy itself is all about how a secondary party can become a principal in the first degree by participating in an already ongoing larceny. I don't think there's any support anywhere in the common law or anywhere in Virginia law outside of maybe that quote, which I would suggest is taken out of context in this case, for the idea that a person who steals an object is committing a new offense every time they move that object. As the court pointed out, there's no charge for possession of stolen property because that offense is ongoing all the time. If there was a charge for possession of stolen property, as the assistant Commonwealth attorney noted during the argument in front of Judge Tran, that's the charge he would have brought. He says that right on the record. That it just doesn't exist. And so the idea
now,
that...
Let me ask you this. It's Judge Austin. Could he have been prosecuted as an accessory after the fact?
An accessory after the fact to his...
the larceny.
Is the court's idea that because he is not proved to have been the original thief, he could be prosecuted as an accessory after the fact for possessing the stolen goods?
Correct.
That's an interesting question that I have not given adequate... I have not given it adequate thought to feel comfortable making an answer that might be perceived as a concession at this time. I feel strongly that the answer is no instinctually.
But that issue wouldn't be before us because that's a misdemeanor and the Commonwealth can't appeal a pretrial ruling in a misdemeanor.
That's an excellent answer. Yes, thank you.
But it could be theoretically argued to be some sort of lesser included charge, correct?
I'm not sure that that's the case. That aiding and abetting would be a lesser included offense of the actual act of being the principal thief.
Theoretically, the Commonwealth is unable to prove the predicate larceny offense, and so they drop down a level and prove the misdemeanor, and by granting the motion to dismiss the indictment, it has precluded the Commonwealth from proceeding on its secondary theory, assuming the first theory didn't fly as a matter of fact or as a matter of law.
I'm not sure I can agree with the premise that aiding and abetting is any part of an included is included in any part of an indictment for a person as for larceny as a principal in the first degree.
Let me ask you this. Did your client testify at the first trial?
He did.
Okay, and I'm assuming, I think the record's pretty clear that he said that he didn't steal the dog, had nothing to do with it or something to that effect. Correct?
I believe that's a fair reading of the record.
Okay, so theoretically, could the Commonwealth come back at him now and charge him with perjury?
I have to tell you, sir, that in my experience, answering hypothetical questions about the factual record has gone very poorly for me in the past and might be accepted as some sort of concession by certain judges on the Supreme Court of Virginia in the past. So I'm going to decline to accept your invitation there.
Let me follow up on Judge Alston's question, if I can. It's Judge Humphreys, Mr. Blanche.
Yes, sir.
The Commonwealth confused me a little bit, and Ms. Campbell maybe can address this in rebuttal as well. But the Commonwealth has taken the position, as I understood it, at trial, and I'm not sure if now, given the oral argument, that it's necessarily taken the same position on appeal, that this is a continuing offense. And it seems to me Judge Tran relied heavily on the fact that it is a continuing offense to conclude that if it's a continuing offense, that supports the proposition that it's the same offense because it's the same offense that has continued. In other words, it's not complete in that sense. And so, but now I hear the Commonwealth arguing that it's a separate offense despite its continuing nature, which I'm not sure I understand, but unless we're just talking about venue as opposed to the same offense. But with respect to your position, and I know you threw collateral estoppel and ultra fa quid in your brief. Was any of that ruled on by the trial court?
The one thing that I feel absolutely was ruled on by the trial court, and I guess to preface this, as the court I'm sure knows, the trial court didn't need to rule on it as long as there's an adequate factual record for you all to conclude that those doctrines apply here, and of course you can assign those reasons to affirm the judgment. I will say that absolutely Judge Tran made a collateral estoppel or res judicata ruling. His statement in the record, and if you'll bear with me while I pull that up, was that the Commonwealth would have to prove, here it is, when seeking to bring another larceny charge of the same dog, the Commonwealth must prove factual issues that may have been previously resolved in the first jury trial. And as I cited on brief, and I think it's the ACAC Corp case, the essential element of a res judicata plea is not necessarily that that the exact factual issue was resolved, that's collateral estoppel. Res judicata says as long as the issues might have been resolved in the previous trial, you have mutuality of parties and so forth, that's an adequate basis for the court to say this is a barred prosecution.
Mr. Blanchard,
I guess my question would be, which was the basis for Judge Tran's ruling, collateral estoppel or just straight up double jeopardy? Because
I would suggest to the court that he made both rulings. He certainly explicitly made a ruling about double jeopardy, and I believe his holding, the holding that I just quoted, is an explicit endorsement of the idea that res judicata applies as well, because he stated that sentence is written in the exact form of the elements of res judicata.
But Mr. Blanchard, you raise the argument that there's a separate and distinct collateral estoppel holding by the court. Is that correct?
No, I believe my argument with respect to collateral estoppel is that it is a basis which this court could assign in to affirm the trial court's ruling without having to even reach the merits, for instance, of the double. Say the court found that double jeopardy didn't apply.
The collateral in Ashby Swenson, the Supreme Court made it pretty clear that collateral estoppel is a component of double jeopardy. It's issue preclusion as opposed to preclusion of further prosecution, but it's grounded in double jeopardy. So I don't understand how we decide that as a separate basis for the trial court's ruling.
Well, Your Honor, you're absolutely right in the sense that Ash versus Swenson says that the Fifth Amendment incorporates, the double jeopardy clause incorporates res judicata. But res judicata was a common law doctrine, of course, that predated the double jeopardy clause by hundreds of years. And it exists independently of the double jeopardy clause. So if the trial court had, for instance, said explicitly, I'm ruling, and I suggest that they did, if the trial court said explicitly, res judicata applies to prohibit this prosecution, that is not necessarily a double jeopardy ruling.
Wait a minute. Now, I think we're getting
res judicata and double jeopardy.
I'm sorry?
In this circumstance, what's the difference between res judicata and double jeopardy? I understand the difference between collateral estoppel, but I don't understand what's different about res judicata.
The double jeopardy clause incorporates a number of old common law doctrines, artifice quid, res judicata, but those doctrines have different elements. So, and of course, the double jeopardy clause includes additional protections against multiple prosecutions that aren't incorporated by either of those common law doctrines.
I think you're sort of correct, but it seems to me that the doctrine of ultra fois acquit and ultra fois convict they go back to the English common law, and the problem was they could be trumped by the king, sovereign, and that's why they were written into the Bill of Rights, basically in the form of the double jeopardy clause, as well as multiple punishments for the same offense, which is not involved in either of those doctrines. But collateral, just Petty's point, I think, is simply that in terms of how we analyze this issue, and I guess how Judge Tran may have analyzed the issue, the collateral estoppel is a fact preclusion doctrine. In other words, it involves relitigating the same fact between the same parties that's already been resolved in another proceeding. Whereas res judicata is an issue preclusion doctrine, and I guess double jeopardy is sort of the same as just Petty pointed out, and that's what issue preclusion analysis, because we're trying to decide whether you can even go to trial to resolve the issue if it's already been resolved in another proceeding. So it seems to me analytically we wouldn't even get to collateral estoppel, and we wouldn't be worrying about what facts need to have been precluded unless we can reach the underlying issue in the first place. So it seems to me analytically we'd have to resolve the double jeopardy issue before we would even consider whether or not to go down a collateral estoppel road. Would you agree with that?
I think the court is in the best position to make a determination about which issue is,
We don't know. We don't care.
Well, I think that there are at least five different ways, as my brief points out, that this court could affirm the trial court's ruling. And I don't think my client particularly cares which one you choose. I think that you could just cite Brown versus Ohio in one sentence and be done with the analysis of this case. I think Brown versus Ohio is absolutely on point, and that handles the issue. If, however, the court concludes that it would like to decide the case on a different ground that it thought was a narrower ground, which is the court's obligation in that situation, and if the court felt that collateral estoppel or res judicata provided a narrower ground to decide the case, then I think that the brief provides the ammunition for the court to do that.
But I understood, and this is why I was asking about that the res judicata. You seem to indicate that a ruling on res judicata is not subject to appeal by the Commonwealth.
That's
your argument.
Yes.
And circling back to that, I don't understand what it is, how a res judicata claim can be made in the absence of also concluding that it's double jeopardy. What is distinct and different about res judicata?
Well, res judicata is, on its own, a common law doctrine that existed prior to and exists after the Fifth Amendment. So if a trial court, for instance, wanted to be creative and avoid review on appeal, for instance, it might make a ruling on a common law basis as opposed to a constitutional basis. And, for example, one of those things happened fairly recently that I'm aware of, where a trial court made a ruling on a hearsay basis about prior testimony.
I understand that. What I'm asking is, what is different? I mean, what wasn't incorporated into the double jeopardy clause from the common law concept of res judicata? How is that separate and distinct?
I think if the court's looking at it from that angle, there is no difference.
All right.
My argument is simply that the trial court could have asserted that basis alone, and this court could affirm the trial court's ruling on that basis alone without even referencing the double jeopardy clause if it chose to.
All right. Thank you. Your time has expired. And Ms. Campbell, you have about 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, the Commonwealth just wants to respond to the defendant's assertion that the appeal would be moot because of the res judicata ruling. The Commonwealth's position is that the defendant takes that sentence that he read to the court out of context of the court trial court's opinion letter. Throughout the opinion, the trial court only mentions double jeopardy as the issue raised by the defendant and explicitly rules on double jeopardy. Furthermore, the usage of the word may in that sentence prove factual issues that may have been previously resolved. Points out that the trial court was merely speculating that if the case went to trial, there might be issue preclusion issues related to evidence presentation.
Campbell, can you answer my question that I posed to your opponent earlier about at least what I perceive to maybe be inconsistent positions taken by the Commonwealth here? In other words, the effect of this being a continuing offense, it seems to me if it is a continuing offense, that bolsters the argument that it's the same offense as opposed to, you know, because it's an offense that continues, and everybody seems to agree that this is essentially a continuation of the original theft. So how can larceny be both continuing and separate based on the date of the offense? Can you kind of parse that one for me?
Yes, I can try to give you the best answer I can. The Commonwealth's position would be that because he was not the person who originally took the dog on that day, larceny is a continuing offense because the property rights continue in the owner, so therefore anyone who subsequently participates in violating those property rights is continuing to commit the larceny. However, if the Commonwealth can prove that separate actions occurred, those can be tried as separate and distinct offenses.
Well, now I'm confused. So does that mean that if the defendant were to proceed to trial on the second indictment and take the stand and then testify under oath that I stole the dog back on the first date when I was acquitted, and therefore double jeopardy now applies, that then the court would at that point then have to dismiss the indictment on double jeopardy grounds because of your analysis?
Under
not until that point, I guess.
Yeah, I can't give you a definite answer. I think that the Commonwealth's position definitely becomes worse than if, but,
Well, the trial judge or the fact finder could discredit that testimony, and then that would be the end of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that this is why this case really should go to trial, and so that the Commonwealth has the opportunity to put forth the evidence, and the defendant can put forth his evidence and see exactly...
and set himself up for perjury.
Yeah, let me mind the whole double jeopardy concept. If we have to go to trial on every charge in order to determine whether or not double jeopardy applies, then the whole point is, if double jeopardy applies, you're not supposed to be tried in the first place for the same offense you've already been acquitted or convicted of. So, I mean, it seems to me your argument would basically render the whole double jeopardy concept a nullity. We're going to get into multiple trials for the same offense, and only after we hear all the evidence decide what to do with it.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. And my argument would just be that in this case, the defendant was not placed in double jeopardy for his future bad acts that could not have been contemplated at the time of his original trial.
All right. Ms. Campbell, thank you. Your time has expired. I want all of you to know that the court is sincerely hopes that Ben is home happy and healthy now. And with that, we will adjourn and reconvene in conference. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.